December 1845 represented a major turning point in Kierkegaard's life and writings. He sent to the printers the final work of his pseudonymous authorship, the concluding unscientific postscript. But without a pause to catch his breath after 4 years of incredible literary exertions, he threw himself into battle with a dangerous and vicious opponent, a Copenhagen scandal rag named the Corsair. The Corsair specialized in satires and exposés of the respected and powerful in Danish society. It quickly grew to have the largest circulation in the country. Ironically, Kierkegaard was one of the rare public figures to receive kind treatment at the hands of the Corsair. It even proclaimed Victor Eremita, the pseudonymous author of Either Or, to be immortal because of his great literary accomplishment. But Kierkegaard regarded the paper's praises as a dubious honor.
I will suppose that there was a city where the prostitutes made a practice of abusing all the decent girls once a week. But there was one young girl who was never abused. On the contrary, she was acclaimed and praised. As young girls do, she would throw herself in tears on her mother's neck and say, "Oh, mother, why can't I be abused too? All my friends look at me suspiciously because I am praised."
The immediate occasion for Kierkegaard's battle with the Corsair was an article that appeared not in the Corsair itself, but in a literary collection authored by P.L. Müller. Müller, who is widely believed to be the model for Johannes the Seducer, published a recreated conversation among several Danish literati. Their critical evaluation of Kierkegaard's pseudonymous works turns quickly into moral criticism of Kierkegaard himself. Emphasizing the recurring tales of unhappy love and broken engagements in those works, one of the speakers reflects,
"If you regard life as a dissecting laboratory and yourself as a cadaver, then go ahead, lacerate yourself as much as you want to. As long as you do not harm anyone else, the police will not disturb your activity. But to spin another creature into your spider web, dissect it alive, or torture the soul out of it drop by means of experimentation, that is not allowed, except with insects. And is there not something horrible and revolting to the healthy human mind even in this idea?"
Kierkegaard immediately responded with an article in the newspaper The Fatherland. He took Müller to task for numerous misreadings and misunderstandings. But the real sting in the article comes at the end, where Kierkegaard says that his wish to be criticized by the Corsair has finally, if indirectly, been fulfilled. He reveals that Müller is the spirit secretly behind the scandal rag. This revelation doomed Müller's hopes of becoming the professor of aesthetics at the University of Copenhagen. It prompted the Corsair to undertake a relentless 2-year campaign to deride Kierkegaard and assassinate his character. These attacks, copiously illustrated with satirical line drawings, are invariably crude and cruel. One noteworthy example depicts Kierkegaard riding on the shoulders of Regine Olsen. It's captioned, "How You Trained Your Girl." Incredibly, though, the main subject of these attacks were Kierkegaard's spindly legs and uneven trousers. His incessant walks through Copenhagen, which previously had been unnoticed, now became the center of attention. The heckling and abuse gradually grew so bad that he couldn't sit in church without being disturbed. Kierkegaard had formerly enjoyed talking with people from all walks of life as he strolled the streets of Copenhagen, but now he was completely isolated. He'd expected to pay a price for taking on the Corsair, but he hadn't anticipated how far things would go. Yet, reflecting on the affair, he was grateful for new insights into the spirit of the times and his particular mission.
It is true that rabble barbarism has grown to be a much more serious matter than I anticipated at the time. Even though I considered seriously the step I took and was religiously resolved, that is, I have discovered the baseness and demoralization to be far greater than I had imagined it to be. But for that very reason, I must say that it was good that I got involved. For the more earnest the affair grows, the greater is my obligation and my call.
What exactly is this obligation and call? How does the battle with the Corsair help fulfill it? Having concluded his pseudonymous battles with the Romanticists and Hegelians, Kierkegaard now was ready to take on the secular social order that passed itself off as Christian. The common people had been vicious to him, and the cultural elite watched the fray in a cowardly, perhaps secretly satisfied silence. To Kierkegaard, this was eloquent testimony to the real character of Danish Christendom. Kierkegaard saw his martyrdom at the hands of the corsair as a golden opportunity to change persona, to alter the image he presented to the reading public. Throughout the pseudonymous writings, he'd played the part of a frivolous man about town. He'd attributed his works to fictitious authors, ensuring that their impact owed nothing to his personal authority. Each reader had been forced to decide for himself what was true and what was valuable in them. These practices had perfectly fit Kierkegaard's theory of indirect communication, but now he felt called to challenge the established order directly, to speak against Christendom in his own name without subterfuge. But how could he do this without abandoning his theory of indirect communication? He would become an outcast, a pariah, an object of derision. No one would accept his assertions because he made them, but only in spite of his making them. Kierkegaard spells out this view in a journal entry of March 1846, just 3 months after the battle with the corsair had begun.
The concluding postscript is out. The pseudonymity has been acknowledged. Everything is in order. All I have to do now is to keep calm, be silent, depending on the corsair to support the whole enterprise negatively, just as I wish. In itself, it was a most capital idea to make a break with the corsair in order to prevent any direct advances at the very moment I was through with the authorship and, by assuming all the pseudonyms, ran the risk of becoming an authority of sorts. This is why, right now, when I am advancing polemically against the age, I owe it to the idea and to irony to prevent any confusion with the ironical bad brandy the corsair serves in the dance halls of contemptibleness.
Kierkegaard's second and explicitly Christian writing is sharply partisan. It reads like a polemic. But we shouldn't view him as a man overwhelmed with bitterness at his public mistreatment. On the contrary, he spent many of the worst months of the corsair's attack writing a book, Works of Love. This book, his greatest contribution to Christian ethics, reminds us, in earnest yet beautiful prose, that love and love alone is the fulfillment of the law. Kierkegaard's critics say he's excessively individualistic. They think he ignores or even disparages the social dimension of human existence. The Jewish philosopher Martin Buber traces this fault directly to Kierkegaard's concept of the believer's relation to God.
According to Kierkegaard, the relation to God is an exclusive one, the exclusive one. And this means that it is the excluding relation, excluding all others. More precisely, that it is the relation which, in virtue of its unique essential life, drives all other relations into the realm of the inessential.
We could easily understand that a solitary and derided figure might naturally err in saying that the relationship with God excludes others, but Works of Love shows Buber's criticism to be off target. Here Kierkegaard is profoundly alert to both the possibilities and the pitfalls of human relationship. He persistently emphasizes the distinctive character of Christian love. He contrasts Christian love with friendship and erotic love, the natural human manifestations of fellow feeling.
The object both of erotic love and friendship has therefore also the favorite's name, the beloved, the friend, who is loved in distinction from the rest of the world. On the other hand, the Christian teaching is to love one's neighbor, to love all mankind, all men, even enemies, and not to make exceptions, neither in favoritism nor in aversion.
In natural human love, two people are attracted to each other because of some excellence or similarity they see in one another. But neighbor love accepts and cares for the other person as he or she is, no matter how unlovely or degraded or even hostile that may be. But how are we to love the unlovely? According to Kierkegaard, neighbor love is possible only because it's commanded.
You shall love is the very mark of Christian love, and its distinguishing characteristic is this, that it contains the apparent contradiction. To love is duty. You shall love. This, then, is the word of the royal law.
Kierkegaard notes that saying we have a duty to love others is an apparent contradiction. How can an emotional state, a quality of heart, be a matter of duty? Earlier, we saw that Judge William describes duty as a divine nourishment for love. But there, the love of a spouse was being discussed. There, the task was to sustain an existing love that's based on preference and inclination. But in Works of Love, Kierkegaard says the object of preferential love is not really an other. It is instead another I.
That passionate preference is another form of self-love will now be shown, together with its opposite. That self-renunciation's love loves one's neighbor, whom one shall love. Just as self-love centers exclusively about this self, whereby it is self-love, just so does erotic love's passionate preference center around the one and only beloved, and friendship's passionate preference around the friend. The beloved and the friend are therefore called, remarkably and significantly enough, the other self, the other I, for one's neighbor is the other you.
Love of the spouse or friend is still a love of self. It excludes those who are different and unappealing. But neighbor love, a love free of selfishness and differentiation, is a genuine love of another. Where does it come from? Kierkegaard says God himself is the secret hidden source of the very love he commands.
The hidden life of love is in the most inward depths, unfathomable, and still has an unfathomable relationship with the whole existence. As the quiet lake is fed deep down by the flow of hidden springs which no eye sees, so a human being's love is grounded still more deeply in God's love. If there were no spring at the bottom, if God were not love, then there would be neither a little lake nor a man's love. As the still waters begin obscurely in the deep spring, so a man's love mysteriously begins in God's love.
As strange as it may seem, Kierkegaard's harsh and occasionally shrill attacks on church and society are responses to the divinely commanded and provided love. Had he loved less, Kierkegaard surely would have succumbed to the temptation to laugh ironically at human foibles. As it was, he faced what he regarded as the greatest test of love, the need to appear unloving, so he could help the beloved in the way that's needed.
The inwardness of Christian love must not require any reward. The purely human conception of love also teaches that love requires not reward. It only wants to be loved, as if this were not reward. Men will sacrifice this or that and everything, but they still hope to be understood, and thereby to remain in a meaningful human context, in which one's sacrifices are recognized and rejoiced over. But the inwardness of Christian love is willing to be hated by the beloved as reward for its love.
Kierkegaard reached well back in his pseudonymous writings and edifying discourses to begin his polemic against church and society. But before 1846, when he published the Postscript, that polemical dimension of his writing remained in the background. Works of Love and the other religious writings of this period have a serene yet earnestly joyful style, but they indirectly criticize domesticated Christianity. They criticize simply by describing the real article. They represent, as Kierkegaard put it at one point, thoughts that wound from behind. In Two Ages, the first book he published after acknowledging the pseudonymous writing as his own, he begins the frontal assault in his era. Two Ages, though ostensibly a review of a novel, contrasts the Denmark of his day with the Denmark of the previous generation, an earlier time that Kierkegaard calls a revolutionary age. The earlier generation had been passionate and active, but Kierkegaard finds the present one reflective and passive. We should recall that reflectivity and passivity are exactly the traits Kierkegaard criticizes in Hegelians. Hegel's philosophy, and especially its tendency to be abstract and self-forgetful, is merely a symptom of a broader social illness. This illness shows up even more ominously in the public, that abstract entity that is both all-powerful and invisible.
The public is not a people, not a generation, not one's age, not a congregation, not an association, not some particular persons. For all these are what they are, only by being concretions. The public is all and nothing, the most dangerous of all powers and the most meaningless. One may speak to a whole nation in the name of the public, and yet the public is less than one ever so insignificant actual human being.
The public is an anonymous they that functions as the final arbiter of fashion, in clothing, in politics, art, and literature. Kierkegaard anticipates a number of 20th century philosophers, notably Martin Heidegger and José Ortega y Gasset, when he associates the public's rise with the development of mass communications. Newspapers, in his day the primary tool of mass communication, attempt to maximize circulation by publishing anonymous articles tailored to the lowest common denominator of taste. Kierkegaard says the press has lifted mediocrity up to authority, and they've loosed on society the demon of leveling. They systematically suppress any difference and distinction, any rise above the ordinary and customary. When we add together this spirit of leveling with the public's insatiable need for diversion and the press's eagerness to provide it, we have all the ingredients for the Corsair's attack on Kierkegaard.
If I were to imagine this public as a person, I most likely would think of one of the Roman emperors, an imposing, well-fed figure suffering from boredom and therefore craving only the sensate titillation of laughter. So this person, more sluggish than he is evil, but negatively domineering, saunters around looking for variety. Anyone who has read the ancient authors knows how many things an emperor could think up to beguile the time. In the same way, the public keeps a dog for its amusement. This dog is the contemptible part of the literary world. If a superior person shows up, perhaps even a man of distinction, the dog is goaded to attack him. And then the fun begins. The nasty dog tears at the coattails, indulges in all sorts of rough tricks, until the public is tired of it and says, "That is enough now." So the public has done its leveling. The superior one, the stronger one, has been mistreated. And the dog, well, it remains a dog that even the public holds in contempt. And the public is unrepentant. For after all, it was not the public. In fact, it was the dog.
Kierkegaard sees in the public the social and political symptoms of a deeper religious malady. He says the public is the natural consequence of Christendom. To address this problem at its deepest roots requires a clear, forceful statement of true Christianity. He must also denounce the imposter, official Christianity. Surprisingly, Kierkegaard again resorted to a pseudonym, Anticlimacus, when he published two important books, The Sickness Unto Death and Practice in Christianity. But this time the pseudonym functions in a very different way. Kierkegaard previously had used pseudonyms to express viewpoints that were not Christian and which he'd already left behind. But Anticlimacus writes from an uncompromising Christian perspective. Kierkegaard was reluctant to claim this perspective for himself because he didn't measure up to its demands. But Kierkegaard endorsed everything Anticlimacus has to say, so he placed his own name on the title page of the two books as editor. The first, The Sickness Unto Death, is subtitled A Christian Psychological Exposition for Upbuilding and Awakening. It was published in 1849. The opening paragraphs are among the densest passages in Kierkegaard's writings. It's intellectually demanding, but it's not an abstract, disinterested piece of scholarship. Rather, it concerns the most existentially relevant of issues. Anticlimacus tells us in the preface that the book resembles the speech of a doctor at the sickbed of a gravely ill patient. But the illness under consideration here is no physical malady. It's despair, the true sickness unto death.
Only the Christian knows what is meant by the sickness unto death. As a Christian, he gained a courage that the natural man does not know. And he gained this courage by learning to fear the even more horrifying. This is the way a person always gains courage. When he fears a greater danger, he always has the courage to face a lesser one. When he is exceedingly afraid of one danger, it is as if the others did not exist at all. But the most appalling danger that the Christian has learned to know is the sickness unto death.
In some of his most penetrating writing, Kierkegaard analyzes despair as the self's misrelation to itself, the self's failure to accept itself as it is. But this has further implications. Because we didn't create ourselves, but were created by God, the self's misrelation to itself is also a misrelation to God. Here we learn why despair is the true sickness unto death, the danger so horrifying that all others pale to insignificance beside it. Despair is sin. It's estrangement from the source of our very being. Anticlimacus says that one form of despair is especially characteristic of Christendom. It produces the crowd. This despair, Anticlimacus tells us, is a spiritlessness so profound it doesn't even recognize itself as despair.
An individual is furthest from being conscious of himself as spirit when he is ignorant of being in despair. But precisely this, not to be conscious of oneself as spirit, is despair, which is spiritlessness, whether the state is a thoroughgoing moribundity, a merely vegetative life, or an intense energetic life, the secret of which is still despair. In the latter case, the individual in despair is like the consumptive. When the illness is most critical, he feels well, considers himself to be in excellent health, and perhaps seems to others to radiate health. This form of despair, ignorance of it, is the most common in the world. Indeed, what we call the world, or more exactly, what Christianity calls the world, paganism and the natural man in Christendom, paganism as it was historically and is, and paganism in Christendom is precisely this kind of despair, is despair, but is ignorant of the fact.
This despairing spiritlessness, this ignorance of what it is to be a self and what it is to be an individual before God, is precisely what creates the crowd, the public, the mass man.
There is so much talk about human distress and wretchedness. I try to understand it, and have also had some intimate acquaintance with it. There is so much talk about wasting a life. But only that person's life was wasted who went on living so deceived by life's joys or its sorrows that he never became decisively and eternally conscious as spirit, as self, or, what amounts to the same thing, never became aware, and, in the deepest sense, never gained the impression that there is a God, and that he himself, his self, exists before God. What wretchedness that so many go on living this way, cheated of this most blessed of thoughts. What wretchedness that we are engrossed in, or encourage the human throng to be engrossed in, everything else, using them to supply the energy for the drama of life, but never reminding them of this blessedness. What wretchedness that they are lumped together and deceived instead of being split apart, so that each individual may gain the highest, the only thing worth living for, and enough to live in for an eternity. I think that I could weep an eternity over the existence of such wretchedness.
Anticlimacus later continues in the same vein.
Surrounded by hordes of men, absorbed in all sorts of secular matters, more and more shrewd about the ways of the world, such a person forgets himself, forgets his name divinely understood, does not dare to believe in himself, finds it too hazardous to be himself, and far easier and safer to be like the others, to become a copy, a number, a mass man.
But why is the spiritless life of the crowd, of the public, so much more evident in supposedly Christian countries than in overtly pagan ones? Anticlimacus says it's caused by a corrupted memory of Christ's incarnation and a perverted understanding of Christ as the God-man.
If men are first permitted to run together in what Aristotle calls the animal category, the crowd, then this abstraction, instead of being less than nothing, even less than the most insignificant individual human being, comes to be regarded as being something, then it does not take long before this abstraction becomes God. And then, philosophically viewed, the doctrine of the God-man is correct. Then, just as we have learned that in governments the masses intimidate the king and the newspapers intimidate the cabinet ministers, so we have finally discovered that the sum of all men intimidates God. This is then called the doctrine of the God-man, or that God and man are the same. Of course, some of the philosophers who were involved in spreading the teaching about the predominance of the generation over the individual turn away in disgust when their teaching has so degenerated that the mob is the God-man. But these philosophers forget that it is still their doctrine. They ignore that it was not more true when the upper class accepted it, when the elite of the upper class, or a select circle of philosophers, was the incarnation.
Anticlimacus asserts it's not Christianity itself, but rather the pale imitation of Christianity preached in Christendom that invites the crowd and the cultural elite to deify themselves.
Christendom's basic trouble is really Christianity, that the teaching about the God-man is profaned by being preached day in and day out, that the qualitative difference between God and man is pantheistically abolished. No teaching on earth has ever really brought God and man so close together as Christianity. But neither has any teaching ever protected itself so painstakingly against the most dreadful of blasphemies, that after God has taken this step, it should be taken in vain, as if it all merges into one, God and man. Never has any teaching been protected in the same way as Christianity, which protects itself by means of the offense. Woe to the babblers, woe to the loose thinkers, and woe, woe to all the hangers-on who have learned from them and praised them.
Anticlimacus's second book, Practice in Christianity, pursues this suggestion that the essential test of faith is to acknowledge and endure the scandal of man becoming one with God. Yet Anticlimacus says Christendom has systematically eliminated the scandal from the concept of the God-man. Kierkegaard had discussed this in Johannes Climacus's Fragments and Postscript. He said that Jesus, the man who claimed to be God incarnate, is a paradox, with a capital P. The paradox for Johannes Climacus was conceptual and metaphysical. It's the paradox that one being could be both eternal and historical. But now the paradox for Anticlimacus has a much more concrete and social cast. He finds it paradoxical that God would choose to become incarnate as an itinerant Judean carpenter, that he came to earth as the lowest of the low.
The possibility of the essential offense has to do with lowliness, with the fact that one who gives himself out to be God shows himself to be the poor and suffering, and at the last, the impotent man.
The possibility of offense is compounded by this lowly, humiliated man's claim to be not only God, but to be our hope and refuge. How strange, how scandalous it is that this man who has no wealth, no station, no place even to lay his head, goes about the land claiming, "Come hither to me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, I will give you rest." Anticlimacus asks of this line,
"Who spoke these words of invitation?" Jesus Christ. Which Jesus Christ? The Jesus Christ who sits in glory at the right hand of the Father? No. From the seat of his glory he has not spoken one word. Therefore, it is Jesus Christ in his humiliation, in the state of humiliation, who spoke these words.
Now we have before us the basic thoughts behind Kierkegaard's attack on the Danish Lutheran Church. This attack consumed the final year of his life. Its essentials had been thoroughly laid out in his work Practice in Christianity, published in 1850, and in For Self-Examination, released the following year. But Kierkegaard bided his time till 1854, when he began his all-out attack in the church. He used the intervening years to fill his journals with ammunition. His reason for waiting appears to be linked to his heartfelt yet disappointed devotion to Bishop Minster. Kierkegaard explains his delay in a journal entry from March 1, 1854, the day Minster died.
Now he is dead. It would have been most desirable if he could have been persuaded to end his life by confessing to Christianity that what he represented was not really Christianity, but a milder form of it. For he supported a whole generation. The possibility of this confession had therefore to be held open to the end, to the very last moment. Perhaps he might have wished to make it on his deathbed. That is why he could never be attacked, and I had to stand everything. Now that he is dead without having made it, everything is changed. All that is left is that by his preaching he has hardened Christianity into a deception. And everything is changed in my melancholy devotion to my dead father's pastor. For it would be too much if even after his death I could not speak more freely of him.
Kierkegaard showed no such reluctance to publicly denounce the new Bishop of Zealand, H.L. Martensen. Kierkegaard had studied under Martensen at the university, and even at that time there was tension between them. But it was Martensen's memorial sermon over Minster that touched off Kierkegaard's battle with the church. On December 18, 1854, the following article appeared in the newspaper The Fatherland.
In the address which Professor Martensen delivered on the fifth Sunday after Epiphany, the Sunday preceding the burial of Bishop Minster, a speech of remembrance, it might be called, for the reason that it brought to Professor Martensen's remembrance the vacant episcopal see. In this address, Bishop Minster is represented as one of the genuine witnesses to the truth. With the figure of the deceased bishop before our eyes, we are exhorted to imitate the faith of the true guide, the genuine witness to the truth, to imitate his faith, for that, as was said expressly of Bishop Minster, was shown not merely by word and profession, but in deed and in truth. The deceased bishop is, by Professor Martensen, introduced into the holy chain of witnesses to the truth, which stretches through the ages from the days of the apostles. Against this, I must protest.
If Martensen wanted to beat Kierkegaard, he couldn't have picked a better phrase than witness for the truth. Kierkegaard had thought and written much about those who witness for the truth, and he'd consciously limited the phrase to those who suffer martyrdom for the truth.
A witness to the truth is a man whose life from first to last is unacquainted with everything which is called enjoyment. A witness to the truth is a man who in poverty witnesses to the truth. In poverty, in loneliness, in abasement, and so is unappreciated, hated, abhorred, and then derided, insulted, mocked. His daily bread perhaps he did not always have, so poor was he, but the daily bread of persecution he was richly provided with every day. A witness to the truth is a man who is scourged, maltreated, dragged from one prison to the other, and then, at last, the last promotion, whereby he is admitted into the first class as defined by the Christian protocol, among the genuine witnesses to the truth. Then, at last, crucified, or beheaded, or burnt, or roasted on a gridiron, his lifeless body thrown by the executioner in an out-of-the-way place.
But far from suffering for the truth, Minster had done rather well for himself as bishop. He lived in a palatial residence associated with the elite of society and received public acclaim for his preaching. What's more, all mention of truly religious suffering was conspicuously absent from his sermons.
Bishop Minster's preaching soft-pedals, slurs over, suppresses, omits something decisively Christian, something which appears to us men inopportune, which would make our life strenuous, hinder us from enjoying life. That part of Christianity which has to do with dying from the world, by voluntary renunciation, by hating oneself, by suffering for the doctrine. So when alongside of it one lays the New Testament, Bishop Münster's proclamation of Christianity was a very questionable sort of preaching, especially on the part of one who was a witness to the truth.
Martensen, already by this time invested as bishop, quickly responded in another Copenhagen newspaper. He said Kierkegaard's tirade confused a witness to the truth with a blood witness. Kierkegaard immediately replied he'd not been confused. He simply concluded from the essential teaching of Christianity that God's kingdom is not of this world. He said to live truly as a Christian, to witness to the truth, is to place oneself at odds with the powers and principalities that rule this world.
The term witness to the truth stands in relation to the fact that Christianity is heterogeneous to the world. Wherefore, witness must always be recognizable by heterogeneity to this world, by renunciation, by suffering.
Is Kierkegaard complaining because Münster, Martensen, and the rest of the Danish clergy live comfortable, easy lives instead of martyring themselves? By no means. Kierkegaard pronounces himself ready to support pay raises for the clergy to make things easier yet. What then does he want? Kierkegaard answers this question in an article published in March of 1855.
What do I want? Quite simply, I want honesty. I am not for Christian severity as opposed to Christian leniency. I am for human honesty. But one thing I will not do, not for anything in the world, I will not, by suppression or by performing tricks, try to produce the impression that the ordinary Christianity in the land and the Christianity of the New Testament are alike.
But it's just this pretense that the clergy of the country are perpetrating.
So soon as it is said that a priest is, at the same time, a witness to the truth, that very instant the established church is, Christianly understood, an impudent indecency. With this assertion, the established church can no longer be regarded as an extreme instance of leniency, which nevertheless is related to the Christianity of the New Testament. But it is openly an apostasy from the Christianity of the New Testament. With this assertion, it is Christianly an impudent indecency, an effort in the direction of making a fool of God.
His conviction that the established church is guilty of this impudent indecency leads Kierkegaard to make an extraordinary appeal.
Whoever thou art, whatever in other respects thy life may be, my friend, by ceasing to take part in the public worship of God as it now is, with the claim that it is the Christianity of the New Testament, thou hast constantly one guilt less, and that a great one. Thou dost not take part in treating God as a fool.
In the United States, we have no established state church like the Danish Lutheran Church that Kierkegaard attacked. But we can be sure that Kierkegaard would be just as critical of the church in America, wherever it's part of the cultural establishment, wherever it caters to our self-satisfied complacency. But it's important to note that Kierkegaard's criticism of Christianity is fundamentally different from the criticisms of later existentialists like Nietzsche and Sartre. Kierkegaard criticizes Christianity not for its principles, but for its failure to take those principles seriously. In all, Kierkegaard placed 21 polemical articles in the Fatherland. When the editors refused to print more, he published 9 issues of his own magazine, The Instant. The Instant contained nothing other than his own attacks on the official Christianity of Denmark. Shortly before publishing the 10th issue, and immediately after withdrawing the last of the inheritance from his father, Kierkegaard collapsed on the street. He was taken to Frederiks Hospital. Refusing communion and all other ministrations of the clergy, he died there 6 weeks later, on November 11th, 1855. He was 42 years old. In spite of his age, Kierkegaard was very much an old man. His body, weak and sickly since his youth, was simply worn out by intense thought and writing. And he'd said his piece. The attack on the church was the natural conclusion of Kierkegaard's long educational project. He'd begun 13 years earlier with Either Or. That effort ended on a bitter note, but his work reawakened a vivid sense of what it is to exist as a human being, and especially what it is to exist as a follower of Christ. This project is nowhere better summed up than in the clearly retrospective preface to his book, For Self-Examination. He wrote it in the summer of 1851, 4 years before his death.
A gradually progressing work as a writer, which had its beginning in either or, seeks here its definite point of rest at the foot of the altar, where the author, who personally knows best his imperfection and guilt, does not by any means call himself a witness for the truth, only a peculiar sort of poet and thinker, who without authority has nothing new to bring, but would read the fundamental document of the individual human existence, if possible, in a more heartfelt way.
We hope you have enjoyed this presentation of Søren Kierkegaard by Knowledge Products. The script for this presentation is by George Connell, Professor of Philosophy, Concordia College. The script is edited by Professor John Locks of Vanderbilt University and Mike Hassel of Knowledge Products. Produced by Pat Childs. Vocal characterizations are by Mark Cabus, Dan Church, Rob Daniel, Joe Keenan, Bill Kulke, Paul Meyer, Anders Otterland, and Robert Wynn. Music is by Ralph Childs. Recorded at Fred Jones Recording Services and Archer Productions. This material may not be copied in whole or in part without the written permission of the copyright owner. Copyright 1990 by Carmichael & Carmichael Incorporated.
Princeton University Press is granted permission for quotes in this presentation from the following works by Søren Kierkegaard, edited and translated by Howard V. Hong and Edna H. Hong. Either Or, Part 1 and Part 2, copyright 1987 by Princeton University Press. Fear and Trembling, copyright 1983 by Howard V. Hong. Philosophical Fragments and Johannes Climacus, copyright 1985 by Howard V. Hong. The Sickness Unto Death, a Christian Psychological Exposition for Upbuilding and Awakening, copyright 1980 by Princeton University Press. Princeton University Press has also granted permission for quotes from the following additional works by Søren Kierkegaard. Attack Upon Christianity, translated by Walter Lowry, copyright 1944, renewed 1972 by Princeton University Press. Concluding Unscientific Postscript, translated by David F. Swenson and Walter Lowry, copyright 1949 and 1969 by Princeton University Press. Either Or, Volume 1, translated by David Swenson and Lillian Marvin Swenson, Volume 2, translated by Walter Lowry, copyright 1944, renewed in 1972 by Howard A. Johnson.
This presentation of The Giants of Philosophy is a part of the Audio Classics series, a continuing series of cassettes presenting the major ideas of great thinkers with a discussion of their historical and intellectual context.